Shifting now from chemistry to blockbuster movie wizardry. If you spent any time in the movies over the past decades, you've watched the progression of special effects. Maybe you even remember Smell-O-Vision. Do you remember that one? I do. Then there was also 3D, which is still my favorite. And then we had widescreen movies to take on television, computerized movies that changed the industry, movies like Star Wars, for example. And the list of movie technologies goes on and on and on to today's completely digitally produced films. I guess it's hard to even call them film if they're not shot on film, but they're distributed on film. Here to talk about how we went from black and white to Technicolor and beyond is Scott Kirstner. Scott is author of the new book, Inventing the Movies, Hollywood's Epic Battle Between Innovation and the Status Quo, from Thomas Edison to Steve Jobs. Welcome to Science Friday.
Oh, it's great to be here, Ira.
Well, I'm interested in your title. Before we get into the innovations themselves, you say the Hollywood's Epic Battle Between Innovation and Status Quo. They never wanted to change?
I think Hollywood, like every established industry, really hates change and wants to resist it. And so you see, if you look at the movie industry from its beginnings in the 1890s to today or to yesterday, you see these kind of two camps always emerging. And one camp is the innovators who have a new idea like Smell-O-Vision or let's make a computer-generated animated movie. And then you have the rest of the industry, which I think is really the majority of people in Hollywood and in any big established industry who just want to keep doing things the way that they do them. They're comfortable with the tools that they use today, and they don't want to change their business models.
So it was actually these folks with new technology that chased Hollywood rather than Hollywood chasing them.
I think that's really true, that it has been kind of pushing technology on the industry rather than the industry pulling it. And it's, you know, it's pretty incredible to think that if the movies were still silent and in black and white, they probably wouldn't have survived much past the 1920s, 1930s, 1940s. It just would have been a blip on the pop culture. But it's really because Hollywood has had its back pushed up against the wall really time and time again that the movies have evolved and they've improved. And now you can go see The Dark Knight on an IMAX screen with digital sound. And, you know, it's an incredible experience.
But you say that even Hollywood resisted color. That's hard to believe.
Yeah, I'm glad that you brought up the color transition because I've lived in Boston for a long time. And Technicolor, the company that really brought a rainbow of colors to the silver screen, was founded in Boston in 1915. And it was a bunch of engineers, or a trio of engineers, two of them from MIT, who got enchanted with the movies in the teens before sound and really thought that it was movies' destiny to be in color. But it took them almost 25 years to convince the industry that it wanted to be in color. And it was just an incredible progression of both improving the technology so that you know, you could shoot movies in color that didn't require really hot lights, and you could run the Technicolor film through the projector without it getting warped. They needed allies in the industry along the way. Douglas Fairbanks made one of the first Technicolor movies called The Black Pirate, and then Walt Disney picked it up. But it wasn't really until 1939 that the technology was good enough and that mainstream movies started to experiment with it. 1939 was the year that both The Wizard of Oz and Gone with the Wind came out, both in Technicolor. Gone with the Wind won the Best Picture Oscar that year, and beating out Wizard of Oz. And that was kind of the beginning of the industry. That was the start of the tipping point, really, that convinced the industry that, yeah, actually, color movies are a good idea.
Talking about the technology of movies this hour and Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News, I'm Ira Flatow, talking with the author of Inventing the Movies, Hollywood's Epic Battle Between Innovation and the Status Quo, from Thomas Edison to Steve Jobs, Scott Kirstner. And you seem to say in your book we're facing that same resistance now into the digital age. Even though that we now think all these films are made in digital, very few are.
Yeah, it's still a rarity. Even in 2008, you know, you can count the movies on one hand that were shot with a digital camera. A lot of cinematographers are still comfortable with film. They can get film to look great. You know, they can shoot a sunset, and that sunset is going to look like the most beautiful, brilliant sunset you've ever seen on the screen. And I think a lot of them look at these digital cameras and say they're not good enough yet, or I'm not comfortable yet enough with this technology, or I just don't have time. You know, cinematographers in Hollywood go from one project to the next to the next. And when I interviewed a few of them, they just said, I didn't really have time to evaluate. I even talked to Peter Jackson around the time that his King Kong remake was coming out. And he said, you know, to be honest, I just haven't had time in between projects to evaluate the latest the latest digital cameras. And he's actually started, he just shot last year an experiment with a new digital camera. So, but it is true that most of the movies you'll see at the multiplex this weekend were shot on film, and they're still playing up in that projection booth behind you on film.
Whatever happened to 3D? That was my when I saw Dial M for Murder in 3D, that was terrific. I mean, I've seen a few 3D movies. You can't find them, but they seem almost to be coming back now.
Yeah, there's really a resurgence of 3D, I think. The first boom of 3D was, I don't want to date you, Ira, but you know, the first boom was in the 1950s with movies like Dial M for Murder and Buona Devil. It didn't last into the 60s, really. And that boom was caused by television. The movie industry was looking for any technology. There were actually 3D movies as far back as the teens and 20s. But in the 50s, the movies needed a technology to differentiate themselves from television. They saw television starting to come into our living rooms, and they said, we need to make the experience at the movie theater different from television. And so you got cardboard red and blue glasses. You got movies like Dial M for Murder in 3D. A lot of people said they got headaches from watching those movies. And now you're having this digital 3D resurgence. The latest one, I think, was Journey to the Center of the Earth this summer that was shot with a digital camera. Brendan Fraser was in that. And people say that it's definitely a lot crisper, less fuzzy than 3D in the 50s. And again, it's being driven by technology in the home. You know, DVDs and high-def DVDs look great if you have a plasma or an LCD TV at home, and the movies are really struggling to continue to give people a reason to, you know, to come out on a Saturday night and spend, you know, $20-$30 for date night.
Even the IMAX CDs, 3Ds are terrific also.
Yeah, you know, IMAX can be a great experience. Sometimes I feel like when you're watching Hollywood movies on the IMAX screen that it's a little bit too absorbing, and, you know, I want to have my peripheral vision back. You know, I feel like I'm being dominated in some way.
Okay. Yeah, that is pretty. It's a pretty overwhelming experience. But you know, I remember seeing a Galapagos IMAX 3D. They just, you know, I thought I had the animals sitting there in my lap. Well, we're going to take a short break.
Hang on. I was just going to say, I think the science documentaries tend to work better in IMAX than some of the Hollywood movies.
You really get to see, you know, a close up in 3D what these animals look like, and it's a life changing experience, I think. Stay with us. We're going to come back and talk lots more with Scott Kirstner, who is our author of Inventing the Movies, Hollywood's Epic Battle Between Innovation and the Status Quo, from Thomas Edison to Steve Jobs. Your phone calls. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. It will be program note. On Wednesday, Neil Conan will broadcast live from the museum in Washington, along with Ken Rudin, NPR's political junkie. And if you're going to be in Washington and want free check tickets to join the audience for a live broadcast, send an email to tickets@npr.org. We might even know who Barack Obama's running mate is by then. You never know. We're talking this hour about how inventions have changed what we see at the cinema. My guest is Scott Kirstner, author of the book Inventing the Movies, 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to the phones, to Terrence in Gaithersburg, Maryland. Hi, Terrence.
Good afternoon.
Hi there.
In about the year 2000, a special effects artist told my alma mater that the next frontier, the final frontier, was rendering realistic-looking humans. And I know that there's some with computers. I know there's some resistance now, you know, with Beowulf and films like that. But I was wondering if Hollywood actually wants to continue going in that direction, or they just want to, hire big-name actors and just stand in front of a green screen all day.
Good question. Is it cheaper to make all these computer-generated, because we're seeing so many more of them, than hire the actors?
Well, there may be an actor's strike coming up soon, so I think having those computer-generated characters waiting in the wings for their star turn might not be a bad idea, and maybe that's part of the motivation, is that actors can be temperamental. Sometimes you have to persuade them to come out of the trailer. Computer-generated characters, they're always ready, and they say the lines you give them. They don't try to change it. I don't really understand. I mean, I know that for graphics people, they just had the big computer graphics conference a week or two ago in Los Angeles called SIGGRAPH, and they're always trying to make humans on the screen look more realistic, and there's this phenomenon called the Uncanny Valley where, have you seen a movie like Beowulf? There's a little bit of creepiness still because it looks human, but then it's kind of got a little bit of plasticity to the skin, or it's a little bit robotic in the movements, and you just don't buy it. And that's why I think Pixar has been so successful, by sort of keeping that, you know, very stylistic, yeah, cartoony look. And, you know, you don't expect the characters in, you know, Ratatouille or WALL-E to look, you know, precisely human.
But the sets are all painted now, you know? I mean, you know, even on television, HBO series, or, you know, like Rome, things like that, they make this huge, you know, all the sets are just painted on in the screen there.
And there's just a difference. You know, I was really mesmerized by the John Adams miniseries on HBO and you know, the way that,
right,
they could create those,
exactly,
environments of colonial America. But, you know, that's a background, and you don't subject it to the same scrutiny that you do an actor in the foreground, where you say, is that a human or is it not? I think, you know, you can do a great sailing ship. You can do a great 18th century building with computers. But I'm not sure, you know, I sort of agree with the caller that I don't think computers are there yet in terms of believable humans. And I don't know if I would put money on them getting there, mm-hmm, I hate to say in our lifetime, because mm-hmm, then I'll sound like I'm a, you know, I'm retrograde. But, you know, let's say the next 10 years, that's still going to, yeah, be I feel like a goal on the horizon.
Hollywood has had a few clunkers in its attempts to make things different than the theaters. I'm thinking specifically, and you talk about it in your book, of Smell-O-Vision.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up Smell-O-Vision. And you said you saw the one movie ever released in Smell-O-Vision?
I think I did. It was in the 50s. I was only a little kid, but I do remember. Uh-huh. I also remember the Tingler.
The Tingler,
I think, also had something in the seats or something.
Yeah, they had a joy buzzer in
that's
the seats.
That's what it was.
And the idea was in the Tingler. You know, this was, again, in Hollywood's era of trying to figure out any gimmick, any technology to compete with TV. So Smell-O-Vision first, there was, I think, a 1 or 2 year period where you had not one but two competing smell systems or fragrance distribution systems that showed up in theaters. One was called Smell-O-Vision, and the competitor was called Aromarama. And neither of them survived. I think only one or two movies released in each one.
But because they have smells. Yeah, go ahead. I'm just going to say.
Well, the smells would kind of merge into one another. And eventually it was like, you know, you were kind of in, you know, someone's,
right,
basement with all these funky smells.
I think you had vibrating seats and things in some of these films, didn't you? I remember, was it Tingler or something?
Yeah, The Tingler with Vincent Price.
Yeah.
They put joy buzzers under. I don't think it was all of the seats.
Right.
I think it was some. And the idea was if you could just make some people in the,
right,
audience scream
they
at
scream
key moments, everyone else would go crazy.
Right as The Tingler was, this creature was running down the aisle. So, I mean, they tried to make it look like it was coming down the aisle towards your seat, if I remember this. And this was burned into my brain, as you,
yeah,
can see.
Yeah, it clearly had its effect. The Tingler looked like a lobster, basically.
Exactly.
It was kind of like a crustacean monster.
Crayfish coming down the aisle or something.
And the only way you could get it off you, the only way Vincent Price could get it off him was to scream. And so the audience, the only way you could save yourself,
yeah,
from the Tingler was to scream.
You know where this has been resurrected, though? Are in these theme parks. You know, you go to Orlando, and some of the theme parks have all these little gimmicks in them. They like bolt you into the seats on a ride, and you get sprayed with water, you get vibrated, Smell-O-Vision, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I actually think that those theaters and theme parks where, you know, where they're spritzing you with water, or they're still doing, you know, they're doing smells.
Mm-hmm.
I think at some of the Disney theme parks, you know, they there's one where they kind of do, you know, zap you in the seat.
I think it's the Alien ride or something.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, it's incredibly inventive. They've taken a lot of the gimmicks and technologies from the 50s and kept them alive. And in a way, I sort of wish the neighborhood movie theater was doing more to be inventive about the experience and to make it kind of a four-dimensional, immersive experience rather than just saying, you know, our value proposition to the audience is you come here, you pay us money, and you see something on,
yeah,
the screen, and we'll,
yeah,
sell you some overpriced popcorn.
Because now you're competing with the Wii and things like that that vibrate, and you know, you interact with these home video things. Now you'd think you're right. You'd want to create the next generation to stay a step ahead in the theaters.
Yeah, and there is that question about do audiences want movies to be interactive? Do they want them to be more like video games where you're kind of navigating or choosing?
Mm-hmm.
I remember in the 80s seeing the movie Clue, where I think it paused at a moment and the audience could choose who they thought was the murderer, and then they showed you a different ending based on what the audience thought.
Yeah.
You know, I think you could do a lot more with, you know, with digital projection technology today, and it just still is a question that the industry has, is how much do movies, mm-hmm, want to be like video games?
Do you remember Tron?
I do. Tron was – I talked to the director of Tron. I went to visit him in Santa Monica, and it was a real high point for me to meet someone who directed this, you know, great movie of the early 80s.
That was probably the first real digital movie, I think, you know, with a digital character in it, if I remember.
Yeah, it came out in 82,
right,
and Disney released it, and it really kind of was a flop. It had more computer-generated imagery in it and some computer characters and environments. than anything that had come before. And because it was a flop, people said it really set the industry back, back a ways, because, if it had been a hit, people would have mm-hmm. kept investing in the mm-hmm. technology. But a lot of the people involved in Tron said, it didn't resonate with audiences. And so Hollywood kind of wrote off the potential of computers for a long time, really.
Too much digitized motorcycle racing, if I remember.
They're making a sequel to Tron.
Is that right?
Yeah, Tron 2. It's coming.
Ramin in Kansas City. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hey, guys. How's it going?
Hi there.
Hey. My question is, Blu-ray, it's a great technology, and I have a Blu-ray player, and the picture is really crystal clear and looks awesome. And I actually heard kind of something from a coworker that the next step within 5 to 10 years or something like that will be that they're going to release something like a Blu-ray, but it's going to be holographic. I mean, if you're familiar with the movie Minority Report, the scene where Tom Cruise is watching his home movies and it's kind of coming out in the 3D holographic image in front of him. I would just wanted to get your opinion and see if you heard anything about that, or is that true or what?
Well, I think the Tom Cruise machinery is true. I think people are using that kind of thing as a projector, but not as a home item yet, that sort of mm-hmm. thing. We've been talking about holographs for years, have we not?
We have, and I do think that is sort of a holy grail, is either 3D television, where you hopefully wouldn't need to wear glasses, and there are some consumer electronics companies working on that already and showing some demos. And then obviously, that holographic moment in Star Wars where you have Princess Leia saying, "Help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi, you're my only hope." I do think there are a lot of people in the entertainment industry who want to get there. There's one guy interviewed for the book, Doug Trumbull, who did all the special effects for 2001, A Space Odyssey. And he tried that in the, I think, late 80s or early 90s. And it was, it was one of those things where the technology wasn't there at the time. But I'm always confident with all of these technological revolutions in Hollywood, you see people trying a couple times and failing first. Everyone concludes that it'll never work. And then someone else is naive enough or bold mm-hmm. enough to try again. And lo and behold, you have the jazz singer. Jazz singer wasn't the first attempt to make a talking picture.
You talk about some of the movies that actually changed the industry, and one of them you say is Toy Story. Why Toy Story?
Well, I love the story behind Toy Story, which is that you have two guys, or maybe you'd consider three guys. You have Ed Catmull, who is really a computer graphics researcher trained at the University of Utah, and throughout the 80s, he was just obsessed with this idea of using computers to make an animated movie. And, he would visit the people at Disney, and they kind of didn't really get what he was doing. He was making mm-hmm. still images with the computer. He was making these very crude, sort of volumetric or basically line drawings, dimensional line drawings on the screen. And they just said, "This is not animation. This is not what we do. We're the studio of Snow White and Fantasia all these great movies." But he kept at it. He told me for the book that, he thought it would take about 10 years to make the first computer animated feature film, and it wound up taking 20. So you often see innovators really underestimating how persistent they're going to have to be. And then he connected up with a former Disney animator named John Lasseter, who really kind of left Disney disappointed that they wouldn't let him explore computer animation there. He had seen Tron, a Disney movie, and said, we should be exploring the potential of computers to make movies. And Lasseter and Catmull hooked up. They had some patronage from George Lucas and Steve Jobs. And now you have this company, Pixar, that hasn't yet, I think in 8 or 9 movies, hasn't yet had anything less than a giant blockbuster success.
And that's why the subtitle of your book is the epic battle between innovation and status quo. You had to have these people leave the major studios and even start their own companies to now even sell the movies back to Disney, other companies like that.
Well, that is the wonderful end note of the Pixar Disney story, is that Disney really, even as Pixar was making short films and showing them off and showing what computers could do, Disney still didn't want to let them make a feature. Disney was distributing Pixar's movies, even though they were two separate organizations. And eventually Disney had to shell out billions and billions of dollars to buy Pixar mm-hmm. because their own animation group had just kind of lost its way and lost its focus. So now who do you have running Disney Animation? You have Ed Catmull and John Lasseter, the founders of Pixar.
Mm-hmm. Are any cartoons made with cells anymore? That's all over. No one pan paints these.
No, you still see movies. Persepolis was a recent kind of indie hit that was that used hand-drawn animation. And the interesting thing, I still think there's going to be... I'd like to think that great art like that is never going to go away in the same way that oil paintings and frescoes... maybe frescoes are not as popular as they once were, but oil paintings, you know, people still do that even though we have photography and videography. Interestingly, the guys at Pixar, now that they're running Disney Animation... they have plans to do, or they're in production now, of a hand-drawn movie called The Frog Princess that I think is going to be out next year or 2010.
Mm-hmm. Talking about the movies this hour and Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow here, talking about the movies with Scott Kirstner, author of Inventing the Movies. Any frontiers that you see that are developing we should keep an eye open for?
Boy, the question about holographic imagery and 3D was really a great one. I mean, I think that's an interesting frontier. I think that figuring out how Hollywood studios can take advantage of internet video, kind of what are they going to do with video delivered over the internet, is really one of the big challenges today. And you see them still trying to say we want to distribute our TV shows and our movies over the internet, and we want to sell you or rent you a 90-minute movie over the internet. But really, I think what YouTube has shown us is that people are spending their coffee break or, you know, goofing off at work watching these little 2 and 3 and 4 minute videos. And so I think for the business and for the creatives, the challenge is, you know, what do you do with the internet? Yeah. What do you do with this medium where the distribution is free? It costs them almost nothing to get the content to you. Yeah. But, you know, people don't want to sit there watching a 90-minute movie in most cases, you know, while they're... while they're at work or while they're looking at their iPod on the train.
Mm-hmm. Just as Pixar had to start up to take on the Hollywood moguls, are we going to see other companies, maybe somebody from these smaller YouTube societies, taking on Pixar's, making the smaller movies?
Yeah, I think you're already seeing a lot of independent filmmakers and content creators doing interesting stuff on the internet. There are these video series that you wouldn't look at them and say, this is great cinema, but... You know, there was a series called Lonely Girl 15 that was kind of a confessional, you know, teenage girl talking to the camera in her bedroom. Michael Eisner is trying to do some short form video. He had a series called Prom Queen that came out last year. Now that he's sort of not at Disney anymore, he's experimenting with this stuff. And you have lots of people who are really outside of the Hollywood industry or on the fringes of the Hollywood industry saying, you know, this is a medium where we can kind of get our break. And it can be people like the guys who did the Mentos and Diet Coke videos that were so popular a year or two ago. You know, they live in Maine, you know, and they're up in the woods of Maine, essentially, with a video camera. And suddenly their stuff is seen by tens of millions of people.
Yeah. So let's keep our eyes out for the new talent. We don't know where it's coming from, as usual.
I think that's true. I mean, you know, you do see a few experiments. There was one a month or so ago. Joss Whedon, who's kind of a very, you know, fairly mainstream TV and movie director, while the writer's strike was happening last year, you weren't allowed to write movies or TV shows, but there was kind of a loophole where you could create other kinds of content. And so he created this 3-part series called Dr. Horrible's Sing-Along Blog. And he did it both as a creative experiment about how could you tell stories and create characters in these little 7 or 8 minute segments. And I think also as a business experiment of, you know, he kept the budget to, you know, $100,000 or $200,000, which is very low. You know, that's the donut budget on most big movies.
We have to say goodbye to Scott. Thank you, Scott Kirstner, for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Author of Inventing the Movies, Hollywood's Epic Battle Between Innovation and the Status Quo, from Thomas Edison to Steve Jobs. Speaking of movies and videos, Flora Lichtman, our producer for digital media, is here with our weekly video pick of the week. What have we got today, Flora?
Well, it's actually a pretty good segue. So I talked to this researcher in the UK who has used 3D motion capture, which is what they use for The Matrix and Lord of the Rings, but he's strapped it onto elephants.
So we have elephants with 3D.
Right. So his main interest is how do these extra large animals, and he's looked at T-Rex too, how do they move exactly? Because, you know, they've got this big battle with gravity.
Right. And there's some mythology that he found that T-Rex may not be as fast studying the locomotion of elephants.
So his T-Rex work predates his elephant work, but basically he's trying to cover the whole extreme animal field. But he found, that if his model showed, basically, that for T-Rex to be super speedy, a huge amount of its legs would have, a huge amount of its weight would have to be muscle in its legs.
Wow.
Like 40% of its weight would have to be leg muscle.
Wow. And you, we can, that's up on our video pick of the week.
That is the pick of the week. He's got some pretty cool footage of dinos and bones recreated and elephants.
Flora Lichtman, check it out on sciencefriday.com, our video pick of the week. Thank you, Flora.
Thanks.
That's about all the time we have today. You can surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com for that video pick of the week and dozens of other videos that are on there. Also, we have podcasts and we're taking blogs and doing all kinds of interesting stuff on the website. And we invite you to send us email there. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.